Hello kids, welcome to episode 6 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written word and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region and their leaders, past, present, and emerging. And now, Anything But the Light by Nick Petru. There was no escaping the lights. Some believed they were God, come to judge humankind. That was why some people drove or ran straight into them, the radiation flaying them before they reached the center. But Leon wasn't so foolish. As with everything I had faced so far, humanity would find a way. It certainly had nothing to do with God. Leon had been with his wife and daughter in their home in the dimmer zone between two of the lights when they appeared out of nothing. Night became day, and Leon acted quickly. He closed every blind and curtain and moved his family into the windowless ensuite in the center of the house. Within minutes, the media, like parts of the planet, was aflame. The family huddled in the bathtub, watching the news on Leon's phone. Some screams came through the speakers, some from outside. For a moment, Leon thought his neighbors had the meat smoker going. The news footage, shot with an optical filter, showed a 10-story-high crystal shard in the center of one of the lights, floating a few meters above the ground. It was just one of the thousands that had materialized at equidistant locations around the world. People pointed fingers for a few days before agreeing that the lights weren't the weapon of any nation. They agreed they were growing brighter, too. Leon's power went out shortly after the announcement. It snowed ash, and the days became one. All Leon could see when he peeled the aluminium foil from the corner of his second-story kitchen window was a white light glowing through the smoke. Several human silhouettes dashed across the street below. A gunshot broke the silence. Leon wondered when, not if, he would have to use his father's old bolt-action rifle. Would 11 rounds be enough? He stuck the foil back in place, took off his sunglasses, and returned to his wife and daughter in the ensuite. Claire's cough had devolved into a wheeze. She was too dehydrated to cry. Debbie's eyes were too big. Leon brushed Claire's hair from her face and kissed the top of her head. It's okay, sweetie. It'll all be over soon, Daddy promises. Debbie closed her bony arms around her husband and daughter. I think we should pray, Leon. No. Leon broke the embrace. We don't need prayer. We don't need judgment. Leon loaded his rifle with 6 of his remaining 9 rounds, 5 in the magazine, 1 in the chamber, and crawled in through Hank and Sue's dog door at what used to be nighttime. They slept on their sides on their black bed, spines touching. Leon was used to the smell. He wept when he found the 15-litre bottles of water in their roof space. It took him half an hour to move all four across to his house. He hid under an umbrella wrapped in foil, fought for each breath through his dusk mask. The job done, he carried one bottle upstairs to the ensuite and set it down beside the bath in which his wife and daughter lay. "I told you things would get better, didn't I?" Leon sat in the dark in the downstairs bathroom with a .22 hollow point in his palm. Outside, a woman's screams grew louder and louder, then crescendoed, and died. Sometimes, the runners managed to cry out to God before they fell. More often, they couldn't take the pain. They ran blindly away from the light, layers of their skin still shrinking, rolling up to their elbows like elastic bands. No one had tried Leon's house yet. Maybe it would be better if they did. Better them than the light. Humanity were worms in the broad beam of a magnifying glass. Sizzling, yes, but also being studied. Revealed. What would it feel like? Leon went upstairs to the kitchen and peeled a strip from the foil covering the window. A sword of light fell on the tiles. Short, sharp breaths, he interrupted the beam with his palm. Hot, but not so bad. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad. Cleaner than the trigger. Leon was down to his last bottle of water. He couldn't sleep anymore. Perspired constantly. He'd finished the bottle in 2-3 days. No one screamed anymore. They had all been judged, for better or worse. Leon lay on the kitchen floor, face centimeters from the sword of light. His eyes stung, tears steamed. There was something righteous about it. Pure, like disinfectant in a wound. A good sort of hurt. He went into the ensuite with his dust mask on and sat against the bath. "Okay, Deb. We can try praying now." His wife and daughter weren't heavy. He lay them on the kitchen floor and positioned himself between them. He held a dozen lengths of fishing line in one trembling fist. The other ends were taped to the foil on the window. He did what he'd been unable to do before, and pulled. It was like a flashbang going off in his face. He flung himself over Claire and behind the kitchen counter, shrieking as his skin continued to peel and his blood continued to boil. Beyond the reach of the light, he writhed and his family crackled. Smoke coiled off of them, just like it had coiled off of their temples after Leon had put the barrel against them and fired. Blinded, nerves screaming, he fumbled his way to the wall against which he had leaned the rifle. The barrel had tasted bitter back then. It tasted bitter now. Better a bullet than the light, though. Anything but the light. The end.
Ooh. I forgot how grim that story was.
You are a grim cunt. But no, I really like that about you, man. Which is weird. That's like a real comment on me, to be fair. but yeah, man, what I really like is I love the pulpiness of the story. You know me, like I've been recommending to you like No Country for Old Men, and we really like cult films like In Bruges and Drive.
I love In Bruges.
Yeah, right? They're brilliant. I think this has got like that same sort of, it's really crunchy and it's grim, yeah, and it's dark. And you can tell you wrote this maybe a little while ago. Like, I think you've written things with like a greater deal of maybe emotional sophistication since then.
Yeah, definitely.
You know? But like, I love like these little worlds you create, these little pulpy experiences, maybe infused with sci-fi and horror. And it really does its job. But what, you know, why'd you write it? Like, why did you inflict that upon me?
Honestly, it's because I hadn't written a, like, apocalyptic story before. And I was like, man, I got to kind of, like, tick that off my checklist. I want to try it out. And I was just thinking to myself, like, what sort of apocalypse would I hate? And pretty much anything to do with heat because, you know, fuck the sun. Like, what has the sun ever done for us?
Well, I'm a ginger, man. Like, I completely agree.
I thought I'd just, like, kind of concentrate that force of nature into, like, these crystalline alien-type shards and just go from there, see what happened. And then I guess the character element of the story came through later. I was like, oh, hold on a minute. I just can't have this, like, apocalyptic world where everyone's dying. Like, there needs to be some substance to it. Like, we need to have someone that, you know, we can empathize with. Maybe he wasn't the greatest character to empathize with in the end, but, you know, you got to have characters in stories, apparently.
Look, he made a hard choice. You know, he shot his wife and kid. But I don't know, man. Like, see, it sounds like a pretty fucking scary world, you know? Like, it's a scary existence to live in, you know? And I don't know. I like the stories you writing now, the stories you actually write now are a little bit more, maybe, as I said, emotionally attuned.
Yeah.
But this guy, this classic example of like father and grizzled mad cunt.
Yeah.
It's like, it's always going to be entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, it's always going to be entertaining.
For sure.
But what I realized reading this is that it's put the stories you've written subsequently in an even better light.
Yeah.
Like, you've grown so much, and I really enjoyed it, man.
I'm not opposed to shotgun finishes, though. Like, I still do have a lot of those, man. I think I wrote two stories recently where, like, the climax is someone getting shot.
I'm fairly certain 100% of 100% of the stories you've read out in here that you've written have involved people killing their families. Or at least cutting ties with them. Nick is trying to tell you something, Petrus. But anyway, thanks for that, man.
No worries,
I'm
man.
I'm really sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
I can't take you seriously when you're sitting there in overalls and nothing else on. Are you wearing jocks?
It's my natural way to be, man. Just accept it.
We made Patrick go and pick up some stands for our microphones, and it's like 40 degrees outside. I sent him out on a mission on his own, and it was pretty apocalyptic, to be honest. Did you feel like Mad Max, like wandering through the desert?
Look, it's so strange to me going to Midland, how lovely Woodbridge is, and it's literally like a kilometer away. Like, it's so idyllic and green and pleasant, and my ex-girlfriend is from there, and she always brought me there, and it was always so lovely.
Yeah.
And then literally like one step further on the train line is just Mutantville.
Oh.
But you know, they were pretty pleasant regardless.
Look, guys, if you live in Midland, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm really sorry as well. It's not your fault that you live in The Hills Have Eyes.
Grim. How's about poetry time?
Cooked by Patrick McCarthy. With a crack, my mind rips back its shroud, and I suddenly come to my senses. I'm high as balls in a festival crowd, viewing the world through speed dealer lenses. I spend a hot minute perplexed as fuck as to where I am and why. My pale skin marred by red dirt and muck beneath a steadily darkening sky. Right then a thought lands a sobering smack. Ah, I'm Patrick McCarthy. That's me. And slowly the details come flooding back about when and who I'm supposed to be. I'm in the heart of Darwin Town on a road trip up from Perth. Come tomorrow, we will fly back down and contemplate adventure's worth. This fest is our last big blowout, our great occasion to get fried, on which we'll drink, dance, kiss and shout, and celebrate that no one died. And so, deducing that, I glance around in search of a friendly face, eardrums thrum in the cacophonous sound of some shite band I can't quite place. I scanned the huge crowd for a comrade through the fucked sunnies I found in the dirt, beneath a cowboy hat and scantily clad in denim overalls and no shirt. My frazzled eyes unblinkingly scan for someone I cherish to know, because I'm aware my loved ones can soothe the ache of any lonesome low. But I unfortunately find no one who looks familiar to me. In the last of the warmth of the setting sun, it's only strangers I can see. In day's harsh light, I knew no fear of all the unknowns milling about. Their faces rife with happy cheer. Of their humanity, I'd had no doubt. But come the darkness, friendlessly, all I see are phantoms abound. An abyssal mass stretching endlessly between starlight and sodden ground. I stare about this sea of cookers, this horde of horrors around me. Their faces enshadowed, misshapen, crooked. From their gaze, I wish to be free. But when I realize I am all alone, all my good vibes turn to shit. A priceless trinket callously thrown to the depths of some fathomless pit. For what's a good time with no one to share the heights to which you climb? In life, joyous moments are exceedingly rare, and in the end, we are all victims of time. In this despondent vein, my strength fades away. Of control, I lose all grasp. I try to call out, but with no courage to say much beyond a most woeful rasp. I feebly attempt to mount a defense of me, myself, and I. But crushed by a solitude this intense, I feel sentenced to wither and die. I ponder all the people I've hurt on my path, the myriad mistakes I've made. Perhaps this is some act of karmic wrath. Perhaps I have some great debt to be paid. Wounded and broken, I hang my head and decide to accept my fate. Rather than fight, I choose instead to give over to pain and hate. I can see myself living comfortably amongst the forgotten and the bereft, until I discover, in amidst the despair and ennui, that I've got no fucking durries left. Ah, fuck me dead, I exclaim out loud. Is my suffering not enough? Stranded here in hell's own crowd, mocked by the gods above. I unleash my fury upon the nearest star, waiting lividly for some sign. When a nasally voice next to me says, "Hey, chill out, my bar. After Siggy's, just have one of mine." In that instant, I completely freeze in the wake of the words just intoned. I turn towards them in the evening breeze and catch the eye of some dude, freshly stoned. His big silly grin, a crescent moon, eyes red as the devil's dick. As the band on stage starts the most pleasant tune, I'm so relieved that I start to feel sick. He pulls me close in an intimate hug, tells me, "Yeah, nah, we'll sort you out." His cherubic lady friend hands me a nug. An act of kindness I'd started to doubt. I look about me at the demonic things, the creatures that had caused me such fright, faceless ghosts yanking my strings, driving me to my spiritual plight. Neon lights flash brilliantly pink and bathe the vast crowd in its glow, bringing me forth from the pit I did sink, shocked how I had plunged so low. Every face was a joy in that heavenly sight, every smile a treat for certain. Shadows banished by that holy light rid the beasts when pulled back the curtain. Then roars back the mushrooms, my high and self distilled, filtered through a kaleidoscope. As the loneliness fades, I find myself filled with that familiar embrace of hope. I pash the lovely girl next to me, after which we gleefully high five. A massive man offers his shoulders to me. I nearly cry, I've never felt so alive. Atop this brute, I can see the whole world, the stage, the fans, the town. I feel my trapped tears begin to unfurl and vow to never again feel so down, because life's a ridiculously beautiful thing and it's an absolute privilege to be. My rapturous heart and soul take to the wing, and at long last, I feel like me. How you going up there, man? Asks someone I know. And I whip round at that most lovely sound. And I see all my friends all stood in a row. And I ecstatically leap to the ground. Where the bloody hell have you been? I was losing all sense of what's mine. They looked at me laughing and said, Paddy, what do you mean? We were right next to you that whole fucking time. Thanks.
I love that one. That's my favorite of your poems because it's not soppy like the other ones. A little bit melodramatic though.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, for sure. I guess I was on mushrooms, you know, and I feel like that whole poem, it's like 5, maybe even 10 minutes long. And that whole like hellscape my mind went to was in the space of like fucking 30 seconds.
Hellscape is the perfect word for it as well. That it suits it so well. Like that's what I was saying about it being melodramatic, but like in the best of ways. It's like those words like accurately convey the emotions you would have been feeling at that time, like such despair. Where the fuck are my friends gone? You know, caught up in your own head, spiraling out of control. I love it.
Yeah, I was sort of like very much. Thank you, I appreciate that, man. I was really influenced by like.
I don't like you.
Yeah, fair enough. That's been established. It's in episode 6. But you know, like I wanted to write something. Like I wanted to write a story about being at a festival and maybe you know make it relatable.
Yeah.
And everyone's felt that sense of doom. You know, like the highs are you know very much commonplace, but everyone has also felt that sense of like apocalyptic doom. You know, like maybe the slightest of things, especially when you're really in that sensitive space, high as a kite, and you know with all your friends in the sunlight, having a brilliant time. And, you know, I was like, fuck, man, I want to compare this to, like, Dante's Inferno, like, digging your way out of the muck. And it felt nice to tell that sort of story.
Yeah.
And it goes really well with, it goes over really well with crowds. Like, I love performing that one.
Already. Oh, yeah. Yeah, every time I've seen you perform that one at the Aardvark, it's gotten a really good reception. Mostly from the younger people, though. I know that, like, Sarah's parents were there at one of your shows, and they're like, I don't get it.
Just go to them and be like, it's about drugs, man. But yeah, no, it's the I love doing that one, man. It went really well at Yardstock, that outdoor festival I did in Fremantle a few weeks ago.
Dude, plug it. Tell us about it.
It's just like, it's done every single year. It's usually done, I think, around like October, November.
Yeah.
And 4 big backyards play host to a number of live performers, maybe bands and poets like myself. And, you know, everyone at the end of the session moves from one house to another and there's like drunken armada. And it's just so much fun, man. And I went there and there was a lady who was on before me who was a slam poet. My apologies for busting the balls of slam poets in the first episode. That, you know, she was really fantastic. But no one was really listening to her. And I was like really close to her and I could hear what she was saying. And I just had the idea to get on stage and tell everyone, look, I have 10 minutes. I have one poem to do. Please just peacefully and amicably shut the fuck up and sit down. And dude, to their credit, man, they just did. And it went really well, man. Like everyone's, and the guy who was hosting it, who just told me, the man, Mr. Yardstock. Mr. Yardstock.
Okay.
He gave me the symbol, like he put his finger up and just said like one more. So that was like a massive compliment for me.
Nice. And sorry, where was that?
So it was in Fremantle.
Frio.
Yeah. Okay. And I was at the South Street house and I think it was the second house. And, soon after I finished, there was another punk band on and they were fantastic. And Then they moved on to the third house, but I had to go to work, so I was fucking miserable.
Rip.
Yeah, I was like a little bit drunk, and I'd been moshing, and I performed, and I was riding that high, and then I needed to like
work give people. The corner.
Yeah. Like I was in such a bad mood. Like I think people were just asking for like extra limes in their Jackson Coke or whatever the fuck. And I was just like, get your fucking hand away from those limes. My boss was like, dude, chill out. It's a lime. I was like, you know. But yeah. Anyway, thanks for listening.
So we've got from you an essay about, well, I don't even know. What is this one about?
I really like Westerns and the genre of the Western. And previous essays we've done have been very much focused on a specific storytelling aspect or a specific character.
Yeah.
And I felt this one, I think I bit off a little bit more than I could chew. But this is what I've written about my love of the Western genre anyway. So, a man alone, but for a horse. Around him naught but dust and sky, and the untamed eternity of nature. He has few drops left in his canteen, fewer shells for his battered rifle, and many more miles to tread. His eyes droop in the heat of the sun. Beneath the scant shade of his hat, he dreams of the immense comforts of love and home. He can smell the washed bed linen. He can taste the freshly cooked broth. He smiles softly. A cold wind cuts his fantasy in two. A lone wolf howls somewhere on the endless plain. He opens his eyes. The sun reddens as it descends. The sky grows dark. He pats his horse. There are many more miles to tread. Though I've always been fascinated by the Western genre, said fascination has changed shape as I've steadily gotten older. When I was a young boy, a man a horseback with just a hat and a gun, alone in a world of peril, was just about the coolest image my mind could hope to conjure in a million years. Like the honor-bound knight-errant and the dashing swashbuckler, the lone, unwavering cowboy made a significant contribution to how my young brain conceived of what it meant to be a man, which is really the only thing every boy wants to be when all the costumes and props are packed away at the end of the day. Capable, brave, strong, badass. If I can for a brief moment disregard the truly phenomenal ways in which contemporary society challenges ideas about gender identity, I'd wager that the cowboy and the genre housing him has been the catalyst for many a boy's determined journey into the vast wilderness of manhood and masculinity, which is totally understandable. He's a massively charismatic figure. When Jack Schaefer describes 11-year-old Bob's wide-eyed admiration for Shane, the eponymous hero of the 1949 classic, we become the boy, and are so too swayed by the immensity of Shane's dangerous yet righteous charm. When Dean Martin sung of the sinking sun, the nesting red wing, and the cowboy dreaming of home, surely any blossoming man listening is entirely swept away, awash in a vision of heroic romance. The cowboy is a powerful masculine symbol, but crucially, I had no idea how powerful until I grew from boy to man myself and saw the colossal complexities of life stretched out before me. As aforementioned, when I was growing up, the cowboy was cool, a mythic figure, calm, resolute, unburdened by anything more than the task at hand, and ultimately good in a pure and simple sort of way. It was a life I envisioned for myself, a template for the burgeoning manhood I didn't yet possess but hoped to one day. I came from a loving family, I believed they raised me well, and as the protagonistic hero of my own story, I felt like a prime candidate for what I believed in my young mind to be the epitome of what a man should be. Little did I know that growing up has a cost. It doesn't matter how wholesome my home life was, how pleasant I was brought up to be. I have hurt others, hurt loved ones, hurt myself, said and done things my boyish self would never consider possible, and taken steps towards experiences that have forever challenged the view of the world I once had. To ruminate on the loss and pain of growing up is disturbing, and yet I look around at my life and those in it, see it replete with love and affection, despite my faults and flaws, and find myself again and again confronted by the question of what it means to be a man. Was the measure of a man the pureness of his heart, as I once naively believed and foolishly aspired to? Or was a man measured by how he navigates the many shades and shadows inherent to him, and balances them to the best of his ability? As a youth, such questions weren't possible, for I hadn't the vocabulary to discuss them, nor the experience to understand them. But now I do, and the Westerns, and the cowboys in them, have changed for good. For example, in Clint Eastwood's Oscar-winning Unforgiven, a young aspiring gunslinger weeps for his soul when he comes to grips with the price of Wild West notoriety. When a family man accidentally kills another, Johnny Cash sings of guilt, regret, and the power of death over life in I Hung My Head. And in perhaps the Western to end them all, Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian puts heroes and myths to the sword with a savage authenticity that mocks the delusions of youth about good and bad. My path from boy to man has forced me to confront hard truths about myself and the complexities of life, and thus the Westerns I've been exposed to have become increasingly complicated and difficult to digest. And so they should. Westerns are about man's nature, which means my own. What they say about the primal forces at work within us each step we take makes my mind race, my heart ache, and fascinates me far more today than they ever did in my youth. And yet, I stand afraid, for there are many more miles to tread. Thanks.
Had to make it about you.
Always, dude.
No, that was great, man. Thank you for sharing that, hey.
Thanks, man. Lick my balls.
I really need to read Shane. I really need to read Blood Meridian. Those are two books that are just like in my scope.
And No Country for Old Men.
Yes. Before we get ahead of ourselves, talking about books we love and such, announcements. So we've got a website now, spinningyarnspodcast.com. Yay. So you can visit that and it shows like, you know, all of our other stuff, our social media and everywhere that you can listen to the podcast, but also a link to our Buy Me a Coffee page where you can support us with money.
Please support us with money.
Yes.
We have no money.
We have none.
I mean, you don't have to. I mean, you can just enjoy it.
I don't know. I kind of feel like you have to.
Okay, you have to now. Now, we just, I don't know. If you fancy it, we just love to be able to go to the pub after we record a podcast. That's
literally it.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Thanks very much.
Well, don't forget your quote.
Oh, yeah.
As is tradition.
I forgot about the quotes. I forgot because I thought we'd shot them in the foot by doing fucking Autobots.
Sorry about that. I couldn't resist.
That was actually pretty funny. I really like an author named Margaret Atwood, but, you know, actually, upon exploration, she's not actually just an author. She's a Canadian poet, novelist, critic, essayist, teacher, environmental activist,
and inventor.
Yeah, which is, I think, is just a greedy list of achievements, really. Yep. She's famed for stellar works of fiction such as Alias Grace and The Handmaid's Tale, which I think a lot of people are very familiar with. And she's been publishing classics and raking in awards since 1961. Her works explore themes such as gender, religion, identity, power, myths, politics, and the power of language. And the quote, which I really like, is, "You're never going to kill storytelling because it's built into the human plan. We come with it."